Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Risk Map Podcast, looking into the last 2 weeks of October 2015. I'm Michael Moran, New York-based Managing Director for Global Risk Analysis in the international risk consultancy Control Risks.
And in London, I'm Charles Hecker, Control Risks Global Director of Research. Welcome to the podcast.
In this podcast, we check in on a spate of elections across a troubled swath of Africa, and we examine continuing risks to the vaunted Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, which was announced by the U.S., Japan, and 10 other Pacific Rim nations last month. But first, Thursday, October 15, is an important deadline in the post-accord implementation process of the Iran nuclear accord. Iran has until that date to respond to questions from the International Atomic Energy Agency about possible military elements of past nuclear activities. Huma Youssef is a senior Middle East analyst for Control Risks. Huma, what questions are asked and what are we expecting Iran to say about them?
The IAEA is investigating many aspects of Iran's nuclear program, but in particular, it's looking to understand what the military implications of this program have been in the past, and in particular, what role certain military sites have played in terms of hosting nuclear-related infrastructure. And one of the main clarifications coming out of this process will be what is the likely role going forward of these military sites and what sort of access will the IAEA have in terms of conducting inspections of these military-related sites.
So is this a kind of opportunity for Iran to come clean on some things and say, okay, here's what we were doing, and that's then no longer held against them?
I think that it has been framed as an opportunity, but it's unclear whether Iran is going to provide all the information about the Parchin military site, for example, and other military constructions and sites that the IAEA has offered questions about. There is a lot of political opposition within Iran's parliament with regards to the JCPOA more broadly. There's going to be a lot of political sensitivities around revealing some of the military-linked information. So it's likely that some of Iran's responses will be vague, guarded, or limited to some extent, tailored very specifically just to get to a point where they can still go ahead and satisfy the IAEA enough so that they can get to implementation day in 2016. There's also lots of requests circulating for any of Iran's responses to be kept as confidential as possible. And I think that there will be sensitivities in the engagements between Iran and the IAEA going forward.
Okay. Well, Huma Youssef, thank you very much. Mike, thanks. Let's turn now to the TPP, the new free trade accord that, if ratified, will set the rules of trade for countries that generate more than 40% of the world's economic activity. Mike, this is being cast as a major victory on several levels for President Barack Obama, who made it a centerpiece of his Asia policy. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, too, is pinning a lot of his reform agenda, Abenomics, on the TPP. Mike, how's the ratification stage shaping up here?
Well, what we're seeing in the U.S. is certainly a fight developing. Under U.S. law, Mr. Obama, before he signs something like this, must give Congress 90 days notice. So we won't see an actual vote until early 2016. And, you know, of course, we've got the political primaries going on here for the 2016 election. So all of this gets sucked into that very partisan atmosphere. But it does appear that Obama has the votes, with Republicans mostly in support, to ratify TPP. The risk there, of course, is that the Republican Party itself is very split between a very far-right element that doesn't want to negotiate or concede anything to Mr. Obama, regardless of whether it fits their agenda, and probably the majority of the party, which is a little more centrist and wants to get this done as something to brag about at the next election. The Democrats, by and large, are against it. So it's an odd situation in the U.S. Our call, though, is that it will be ratified. Japan has made some concessions, very important concessions, to the rest of its partners in the agricultural markets. They are controversial in Japan, but it appears very likely, from all we are seeing, that the agricultural concessions on rice, on beef, and other commodities will actually survive a ratification vote there. By and large, those are the two big economies. They comprise more than 70% of the TPP economic space. Any one of those two dropping out and not ratifying would be probably a fatal incident for TPP. Canada, however, a relatively large economy, is going through an election campaign right now in which one of the three front runners, and there have been three parties at the top of the polls in the last month, has said that he would tear the treaty up, and by and large, Tom Mulcair of the New Democratic Party. I think what we're going to see in Canada is a very, very tough ratification vote. We are fairly sure that the TPP will survive, but if Canada does drop out, it's not an existential event for TPP.
Mike, thanks very much for that. Mike, let's turn our attention now to Africa, where a series of elections will really put democracy in West Africa to the test.
Joining me to discuss the issues associated with balloting in Burkina Faso and in Côte d'Ivoire are Vincent Rouget and Christophe Villa from our Africa team. Christophe, 5 years ago, an election standoff between former President Laurent Gbagbo and President Alassane Ouattara triggered a violent conflict in which more than 3,000 people were killed. You were on the ground when it all unfolded. In 2 weeks, Côte d'Ivoire is going to the polls again. Our analysis shows that a repeat of such a large-scale crisis is unlikely this time around, and that Ouattara is likely to secure re-election. Are there, Christophe, nonetheless, issues that organizations operating there should be concerned about?
Indeed, this election is likely to be relatively peaceful compared to the last one. There will be more frequent protests, and there is some scope for unrest, particularly in the south, including the commercial capital, Abidjan, and in the west. But the main concern, and should be, and this was widely confirmed to me when I was in Côte d'Ivoire last a couple of weeks ago, is around what happens after the election. Despite considerable economic growth in recent years, Ouattara's government has largely failed to address many of the root causes that plunged the country into conflict back in the early 2000s and then again in 2010. These include issues around land ownership, identity, disarmament, and security sector reform. Although Ouattara is likely to be re-elected, probably from the first round, I think this is likely to be in spite of his performance rather than because of it. Ouattara will continue to lack broad domestic legitimacy. Voter abstention is a particular concern in this election. And the succession battle for 2020 is likely to begin immediately after the poll. All of this means that destabilization remains a credible scenario over the longer term, and that a coup, for example, cannot be entirely ruled out over the next 5 years.
Vincent, Burkina Faso is heading towards a presidential poll on the 11th of October when soldiers from the Presidential Guard, the RSP, seized power in a coup. Images the following day of an army colonel announcing the formation of a military government on local television were a reminder of the continued threat of military coups in the region. But in a spectacular series of events, the coup leaders were defeated within a few days, and Burkina Faso's transition, which followed the overthrow last year of President Blaise Compaoré, was allowed to resume. Vincent, what explains the failure of the mid-September coup, and what's the outlook for the rest of the transition?
For a few days, it looked as if the former ruling elite had managed an unexpected comeback. But the coup leaders had not reckoned with the determination of the Burkinabe people for change, and faced with huge popular resistance across the country and an army standing up to their takeover, the coup leaders had little choice but to surrender and hand over power back to the transitional government. The RSP has now been disbanded, its soldiers have been reassigned to other military units, and the coup leaders are expected to face trial soon. And as such, the crisis has eventually provided an opportunity to dismantle some of the last remnants of the 27-year rule of Blaise Compaoré, something that the popular uprising of last year had failed to achieve. With the coup now behind us and the transition back on track, we're expecting attention to revert to the preparation of the elections in the coming weeks. The elections will certainly be postponed, but pressure on all fronts to end the transition should ensure that delays to the initial schedule remain limited. We expect a new government to be in place by the end of the year, after what looks said to be a tight but peaceful election. But various challenges will await the new president, from dismantling a political system that has entrenched corruption and impunity for nearly three decades, to dealing with popular aspirations for rapid change and restoring investor confidence in the mining sector.
Vincent Rouget, Christophe Villa, thank you.
Before we wrap up, a few more blips on the risk map radar in the coming fortnight. On Friday, the 16th of October, China hosts the Asia-Pacific Security Forum, one of the rare venues for discussing multilateral issues in that part of the world. Pending U.S. naval maneuvers near the disputed Spratly Islands are sure to come up on the agenda. Also on the 16th of October, South Korean President Park Geun-hye visits U.S. President Barack Obama in Washington, where security concerns are expected to be on the top of the agenda.
That's it for this edition of the Risk Map podcast, produced by Control Risks, the international business risk consultancy. Our podcast is released every other Friday on iTunes or via the Control Risks website, www.controlrisks.com. Also there, you'll find our annual survey just out of international business attitudes toward corruption. For now, on behalf of my colleagues in 36 offices around the world, this is Michael Moran in New York, saying goodbye.
And in London, I'm Charles Hecker. Thanks very much for listening, and until next time, so long.